This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
So, Renato, how's the prosecution's case going against Trump in Manhattan?
It's complicated. I'm Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst.
And I'm Asha Rangappa. I teach national security law at Yale University. I'm a former FBI special agent, and I'm a legal contributor for ABC News.
And we're here to help you understand topics that can't be boiled down into a soundbite or a tweet. So, Asha, it has been quite a busy week. Obviously, one of the most anticipated trials ever, a first trial of a former president of the United States. And there's been a lot happening. I mean, just today, we're recording this on Tuesday. We had the testimony of Stormy Daniels. Very explosive testimony, heart-wrenching at times testimony. And this week, we're going to have the testimony of Michael Cohen as well. And there have been all sorts of things going on from, a whole gag order fight and lots of nasty Trump truths, I guess you could call them, untruths, and everything in between.
Yeah. So I think today we should just do a Trump trial potpourri, go through all the legal issues that have come up.
Sounds good. And I mean, maybe we should start with the testimony of Stormy Daniels, since that is so in the forefront of our minds. That just happened today. We know how that went. And I will just say that, as a starting point to frame this a little bit, I think Stormy Daniels is a witness who, purely from a legal perspective, like if you're just keeping score, it's like how in boxing, you're watching the boxers, but there's some judges who are tallying points off to the side. If you're keeping score from a legal perspective, she's not that important. Trump technically denies the fact that a sexual encounter actually occurred. But that's really not even that relevant here, because it's clear that he wanted to spend a lot of money to hide this story from the public. I think the value of her testimony and the reason the prosecution was so keen to put it on was to essentially show the jury, this is how bad the story would have been. This is how devastating it would have been. And this is why Trump was willing to pay for it.
Yeah. So first of all, shout out to Delta Airlines for having fast, amazing Wi-Fi on the flight, because I was flying in from LA today. And so I was... And I mean, I guess everybody is getting reporting, but I was literally just following along on Twitter on what her testimony was. And I was shocked by the level of detail, because there were some details that came out that I was like, I'm not really sure what this is probative of, because in evidence, you're really always weighing the probative value against the prejudicial effect on the defendant. And it did seem to me that there were details that I didn't think, it wasn't clear to me what it went to. And then there were some things that seemed a little bit prejudicial to Trump. And my conclusion was exactly what you said, was that the salaciousness itself helps highlight why the story would have been so valuable and why it could have potentially cut through the noise at this critical time when the Access Hollywood tape had just been released and people were already attuned to what Trump's exploits might have been.
That's right. I mean, just to be clear, this was something that was discussed with the judge before his before her testimony. And the judge made clear he did not want vivid details. He did not want sexual descriptions. And I think it was pretty clear that the prosecution went against at least the spirit of what the judge had decided there and was really pushing the envelope a lot. And it went so far that the judge himself jumped in without an objection at times to cut off certain lines of questioning. He was not happy when she's mentioning the missionary position and so forth. And afterward, you know, he went out of his way to let the prosecutors know that he was not happy with that. And, you know, there has been since, you know, since then, a motion for mistrial by the defense, which was, of course, denied. And one thing the judge pointed out is they were not aggressive enough, in his opinion, of making their own objections. So if you don't make an objection, you essentially waive that issue. And, you know, he did note the fact that he did step in at times himself, you know, to try to correct this. And I just want to – there's a lot of different layers here that I think are important for everyone to understand. One is, you know, I've talked a lot on this podcast about the soft power that the judge has, and this is why. Okay, you know, right now there's the NBA playoffs going on. I was watching those some this week, Asha, as an NBA fan. And there's all of this working of the refs that's going on in those games. You'll have coaches screaming at the refs. You'll have players trying to convince the refs of things and arguing that certain things are foul. And it's because the refs are reffing the whole game. And you're probably going to have that same ref later on in the series. So you want to make sure that that person is going to be deciding things in a way that's favorable to you. Here, I will say, I do think the judge is going to be more skeptical of the prosecution in the future when they make assurances of how they're going to comply with certain aspects of his orders. But secondly, the other thing I just wanted to say is there's an element that the judge is not only looking out for, you know, calling balls and strikes when objections are raised, but the reason that the judge is trying to look for the fundamental fairness here, kind of to some of the issues you raised, Asha, is that even if Trump's lawyers totally dropped the ball, there could potentially be a proceeding, a habeas proceeding later, or some other proceeding where Trump's saying my lawyer screwed up, and the judge doesn't want that either. He wants to make sure this is a fair trial and it's going to hold up on appeal or any sort of subsequent proceeding. So the judge, I think, is going out of his way to make sure this is fair to the defendant, even though Donald Trump has been very unfair to him.
Yeah, though, let's talk a little bit about the prosecutors pushing the envelope. I mean, to me, it seems like that's a dicey game, not only because of the judge pissing the judge off, but also like at some point you've got to worry that this might turn off the jury. Like, I mean, honestly, like I'm like just reading some of that testimony, I was kind of like, and I mean, frankly, I kind of felt bad for Trump. Like, I was like, I don't know that this is necessary right now. And this just seems really gratuitous. And I don't know, like, it feels like that could potentially backfire unless it's made crystal clear to the jury why they're hearing that. And I don't know that that was actually made clear.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, one other thing I will just say is I don't think from a purely like what's right or wrong point of view, I don't think it was the right thing for the prosecutors to do. I will say, and this is a recurring theme here, I think that prosecutors often do things that I wouldn't do. We talked about that last episode when we were discussing the Supreme Court oral arguments, okay? It's not like every prosecutor in America is super fair. But I thought that was not the right way to handle that. Yes, I think you're right, Asha, which is one of the things you have to think about, whether you're on the prosecution side or on the defense side, is how your actions are going to be perceived by the jury. On the defense side, when I do am currently in that role, I know the jurors think that I must be some slimeball defense attorney, and I have to build credibility with the jury by showing them that I actually have legitimate arguments to make and legitimate things to say. So I actually am holding myself above some standard. I'm trying to knock the prosecution down a peg. The prosecutors, when I was a prosecutor, we were trying to make sure every punch landed fair. And that's why I was always very careful to make sure I charge cases where I had sufficient evidence. You don't want to be in a situation where you're trying to like have some like punches below the belt sort of thing in order to get a conviction. That's not justice, but it's also potentially going to make you in your office look bad to the jury. I also think, by the way, Asha, and to segue to something I would be very interested in your thoughts on, how is the jury going to think of her? Because I think at times she came off very sympathetic. It's very interesting because I don't think that the defense's cross of her is doing what I would have done in terms of a cross-examination.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that. I mean, in terms of her, how she's coming across to the jury, I think this is just one of those things where this is where if you had cameras in the courtroom, it would be so helpful, right? Because so much of that is body language and facial expression and how she's comporting herself as, you know, she's saying these things. And she came, I mean, I'm curious what you thought made her sympathetic. For me, the things that made her sympathetic seem like they're also potentially legally problematic because they're introducing some of that potentially prejudicial testimony, right? I mean, the account that she gave, I mean, I'll just say it sounded like she was basically raped, you know? I mean, she was like making it sound like she did not want to be there. She did not want to have sex with him. You know, she, like the next thing she knew, her clothes were off. Like she's laying in she's staring at the ceiling, waiting for it to be over. Like, you know, and that it was not something that she wanted to happen, which was a, I mean, I don't know if that's been her account before. That is the first time I've heard of that encounter in this way. And that introduces a whole new element because it really, you know, casts Trump as, you know, somebody who like forced himself on her or something like that, which is like in this case, this isn't the E. Jean Carroll case. That's not relevant to this particular case. And it seems like that could potentially be problematic, but I'm curious what you think.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I wouldn't say, so I would have a more, it would be a little bit more of a shade of gray to me. I don't think she was saying like I was raped. Okay. What she was saying though is,
well, she was saying it was non-consensual, or she was implying was like, that it was non-consensual.
Yeah. What she was doing is like, look, there's various shades of gray to this sort of thing. And the shade of gray that gets all the way up to criminal culpability is different. Right. But I think what she was saying was she got coerced or into a situation where she felt uncomfortable with somebody who had a lot more power than her. And she felt like she kind of was stuck in the situation. It's not, she's not saying she said no or that she didn't, was like indicating to him in some way. I don't think she was saying.
No, they made her clarify whether she said no or not. And she said she didn't explicitly say no.
Right. She was just like there and passive. But the point was, you know, I think that is very humanizing to a witness where, you know, I'm sure there are jurors, particularly female jurors, who've been in situations where you're like, I'm very uncomfortable, but this person has a lot of power in the situation, and I'm just going to kind of go along with whatever the situation is. It's not necessarily rape from a legal perspective, from a criminal law perspective, but it's like not a good situation.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought you were done.
Oh, that's right. But I think that's what she's trying to say. And I think that's very relatable and makes her very sympathetic. But I agree with you that it's problematic. Yeah.
No, 100%. I think that it makes her sympathetic, but at the expense of casting Trump in a light that, you know, kind of adds this whole layer to the encounter itself. I mean, I'm not denying that was her experience. It may, you know, in fact, I'm sure that was a very credible thing. I'm just saying, like, how much. It just seems like that piece of it is irrelevant. that is kind of also going to why after Access Hollywood that this would have been, you know, such a compelling story and, you know, would have tanked his candidacy had it come out. But I don't know.
It was of limited relevance. It should not have come in. But that, of course, and this is another, it's complicated moment. Sometimes things happen in a trial that aren't ideal, In fact, that often is the case. Trials aren't perfect. And what a judge has to do is make sure it's fundamentally fair. So he's pointing out that there weren't objections. So there's some waiver there by the defense in terms of the specific lines of testimony, certain lines of her account. And he, you know, he may give a cautionary instruction to the jury along those lines to say, this is not, you know, saying that this is not, should not be considered for any other purpose other than X or whatever. So, you know, there are ways for him to deal with this, but it's not up to the level where I expect there to be a mistrial. In fact, Trump's team made that motion. It's a very high bar. And this should surprise no one listening because or watching on YouTube because judges don't like to do cases over and over again. So there was another part, though, I thought that was sympathetic as well, Asha, which is that she talked about how, you know, she had kind of an ordinary upbringing, not an easy upbringing. She was somebody who had ambitions to be something other than an adult entertainer. A lot of times that comes with stereotypes. There may be people on the jury who have stereotypes of her regarding that. And not only did she have ambitions to do something else and was a shrewd business person, but Trump recognized that in her, talked to her about that, flattered her about that, and held over and dangled over her the possibility of potentially helping her get on The Apprentice or have TV exposure, do other things as a way of trying to turn a one-time encounter into something more substantial. And I think that also makes her sympathetic. It's sort of, you know, I'm sure there are people on the jury who can relate to having things that you want and ambitions and things that you'd like for your life, trying to make a better life for yourself, or having a position where maybe a boss or a potential employer or other people hold things over you in an unfair way. So I think there are elements there that are a very human story.
Yeah, I agree. What are the mistakes that you think the defense has made since they started their cross-examination?
Yeah, so a couple things. So first of all, a witness like her, I've had to deal with these sorts of witnesses all the time. Okay. Where they're very sympathetic in certain ways, but there's a lot of problems with their testimony, but how you treat the witness is very important. It can, you know, when I was a prosecutor, it might be the girlfriend of the drug dealer. Okay. Who's everyone understands is up there doing what she has to do because she loves this guy. And then, but sometimes it can be, and it certainly could be in my role as a defense attorney, a victim of a crime. Potentially, or something else, you know, somebody else who's a very sympathetic person, right? Stormy Daniels, even if you're in Team Trump, you've got to look at this and say, like, this is a nice, you know, the jury's going to think this potentially is a nice lady who's been through a lot in her life, whether it's caused by Trump or not. And they're going to feel bad for her. And so going after her hard and making her feel bad in front of the jury is like not going to help your side. So you've got to be thoughtful about the critiques that you make. And you have to have a certain tone in cross-examining her. So what I would be trying to think about if I was cross-examining her is a couple things. One is, okay, you know, maybe we have 100 of our greatest hits. What are our 10 best? Like, what are the things that we want to do? What, like, let's not belabor the point and make it seem like we're having a multi-hour attack on her. Second of all, the tone should be very professional and very kind and be like, well, ma'am, you know, this happened or that happened. You would acknowledge too, right? It's fair. You know, it's fair to say that, you know, you made some false statements, right? And you said this or you said that. Things like that where I'm doing it, but I'm doing it in a manner that shows that I'm professional and I'm just doing my job. And it's not a personal. And I think.
And you're not badgering her.
Yeah.
Though, Renato, this is where the lawyers are in a bit of a pickle, right?
Right.
Because Trump wants to see them get tough. I mean, this had to have been the hardest day of the trial for him, I think, because in terms of narcissistic wounds, you know, having someone there able to comment on this most intimate, you know, aspect of you and not being able to speak out, and, you know, his coping mechanism and his defense strategy is always to go on the attack, and he's not able to do that because of the gag order. So he really, I think, at a very fundamental, visceral level, like needs to see his lawyers do that so he can kind of live vicariously through them and expend some of this energy that he undoubtedly is feeling watching her testify, this anger, right? This humiliation or whatever it is. And so I'm sure that he's instructing his lawyers to go after her.
100%. And, you know, one thing we talked about like early on when this trial was starting is I was talking about the challenges that the prosecution had. And, you know, I said that if I represented you in this case, like I'd have a good shot at a hung jury or a misdemeanor or some partial victory. But, you know, this is not me representing you. It's some very different lawyers representing Donald Trump, who's going to get in their way and is very difficult and, you know, probably half the jury hates him. Okay. Anyway, and is going to be very disinclined to vote for him, you know, in terms of a not guilty or a misdemeanor. So realistically, you know, I think this is a great example of him hamstringing his own lawyers. The right strategy, actually, Asha, would have been this: stipulate to the fact that this occurred and say it's totally irrelevant. So what I would have said, the way I would have handled all this is, for purposes of this proceeding, we're going to stipulate that this occurred. We're not going to dispute it. Let's move on. It's stipulated. We hereby stipulate that there was an encounter.
So and what are if you stipulate it, then there's no reason for the evidence to come in.
Right. And what I would do, so the prosecution has to agree to stipulate. Both sides have to agree. But I would put them in a very tough position. Because I would say, Judge, we know that this is very prejudicial. I'm willing to stipulate that this occurred. We concede it. They want to prove it up anyways in some salacious way. That's because they're trying to make sure my client doesn't get a fair trial in this case.
Yeah.
And what do they do with that? I mean, the judge is going to force them to accept the stipulation. Then they got to get focused on the business records, which are a lot less interesting. And on Michael Cohen and so on.
And this is where Trump's coping strategies and defense mechanisms once again gets in his way, because his reaction when he's accused of something is to deny, deny, deny. And I might be wrong, but I think he tweeted something after today that again said like something that never happened but you know, his part, a cornerstone of his defense is that this affair never happened. I mean, he's like continuing to stand by that. You know, and it has like, I just as a throwback, I mean, it just makes me think of like the Brett Kavanaugh, you know, confirmation hearings where Kavanaugh understood that to impress this audience of one, he had to deny, deny, deny. That is what Trump sees as strength. Stipulating to him would be like conceding anything is weakness. Like that's like he would have felt like his lawyers were just throwing in the towel, I think, if that would have happened.
Right. Whereas the opposite, it's actually a very smart way of handling this case. I mean, if you whittle down the case to what really matters and get the jury focused on that, it's a different kind of trial. Like, okay, what's the evidence of his knowledge of the false statements of the business records?
That like, seems like the biggest Achilles heel.
It is. And it's core to the charge, but they're not, the jury's not going to be focused on that. They're going to be focused on like, did he take advantage of this very nice lady in a hotel room or whatever it was, right? That has really nothing to do with the core issue in the case, but that's why a smart lawyer would just try to remove that issue entirely. So I think it's just a very foolish move. So I think, you know, it's another in a series of examples. Another one, and I'll just mention this again, is part of our potpourri because it came up again this week, is the attacks on the judge and the witnesses. Similar sort of thing. Now, I don't think anything that happened this week that wasn't exactly what we predicted in this podcast, which is the judge made a bunch of statements about how he's going to throw Trump in prison. And he didn't actually do it. But that's not a good strategy, like crapping all over the judge. I mean, I think, you know, if the judge was very favorably inclined towards Trump, maybe he would have jumped in more. He had no obligation to jump in. But like, you know, it certainly didn't help crapping all over the judge all the time and attacking him. I don't see how that helps your case. I really don't. And so it's just another example of Trump putting himself in a position where he is making this more difficult.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Yeah, so let's talk about the gag order and the admonition or warning or whatever, which I mean, that both made me, like what Mershon said to Trump, and it was like this kind of very direct and calm speech that he gave to Trump that's basically like, look, man, like, I don't want to put you in jail. Like, literally the last thing I want to do is put you in jail. And I thought an interesting line there was he said, you are the former president of the United States, and you may very well be the next president of the United States. Like, I fully understand the magnitude of what it would mean. Right. And then he goes into some of the practical implications. And it was both heartening to me and also sad. I mean, it was heartening that like this judge was there, I think, acknowledging that Trump was like, I don't know, that there is like kind of a very deep and significant like symbolic value that would entail, you know what I mean, to send like a former president into jail even for a few days for like criminal contempt. I mean, this is part of what Ford was thinking about when he pardoned Nixon, is that like, you know, there's like a certain it's just, you know, he said, and I think this might not be true now for a lot of the country, but he was like, you know, the country doesn't want to see like one of their former leaders like go to jail. And I think he was like channeling some of that. And then, but also to like say, you know, I have a job to do. Like, no matter who you are, I also still have to do my job and protect the integrity of these proceedings. So there was like, to me, kind of like a reinforcing of the rule of law. But then it also made me sad that we're like literally at this lowest moment as a nation, like that we're watching, like really, like the former president like has violated a lawful order of the court 10 times and the judge is like basically telling him like, I really don't want to send you to jail. I don't know, it just, the whole thing made me kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, look, the judge is acknowledging on the record something that, you know, a lot of people have surmised but no one has said. And certainly no judge has said, which is, I am treating you differently than everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I am formally saying that. I am treating you differently than everyone else. I am holding you to a lower standard than I would hold everyone else in this courtroom. I did not like that statement personally.
You did not.
Not a statement. It was not a statement I would have made in his shoes. And I think there are better ways to have handled that situation, in my opinion. But what I would say is a couple of things. I mean, first, Trump is, in his mind, I believe, and I don't know, but I can't read his mind or his heart, but I believe he believes that having an attack on the judge and an interplay with the judge is to his advantage, press advantage, political advantage, whatever. I think he actually thinks if he had to spend a night in jail, that would be to his advantage. Okay. It's not like he's afraid about his safety. They'd make sure he was safe. And that would potentially help his campaign. He'd make him seem like a martyr, being silenced, whatever. So I think he's trying to goad the judge into doing something. And I think that the judge is, the only value of threatening to put Trump in jail, in my mind, is a way of giving a tool to Trump's attorneys to try to rein him in. Because I don't see the judge actually doing it. And if the judge does, I think it's going to create a whole other can of worms that the judge doesn't want to deal with in the middle of this trial. The judge really wants to get through this trial. And I think threatening something you're not going to really do, unless you're just doing it as a wink-wink to the attorneys to say, hey, rein your guy in, I don't know how useful that is. What I would have, what I think would have been more helpful for this judge is to have like a real blunt conversation with the attorneys. And, and make it crystal clear to them that this is just having devastating consequences throughout the trial. And if they want this trial to go well, I'm going to remember this. Every time you ask me to cut, for throw you a lifeline, I'm going to remember the lifeline that you're throwing to my witnesses and jurors in this case. When I'm asking you to have your client comply as an officer of this court and you're not getting it done. And if they offer excuses, they're not going to say they can't control their client. They're not going to move their lips and say that. And I would just be like, I'm not interested in your excuses. I'm interested in results. I don't want my witnesses threatened. I don't want my jurors threatened. I don't, I want this proceeding to go in an orderly fashion. Make it happen, Mr. Blanche. I mean, that is a much stronger way of handling it, in my opinion, than threatening a bunch of admitting that you don't want to do the only thing that you can threaten to do, and you're kind of threatening to do it. Just not the way I would go about it.
Yeah, I think we can disagree. I think like doing the straight on is he kind of understands that what Trump, like the only thing that he hears is when like the adversary like is direct with him. And I think what he was saying is, this isn't a power play. This is, but I will do my job. I don't know. But we can agree to disagree on that.
I think I will just say this. I think everyone has picked up some of our commenters on YouTube have noted how I'm often appreciative when we disagree. I mean, one thing I will say in your favor on this one is it does appear that today when Trump truthed out some things that he immediately untruthed them or deleted them very quickly thereafter. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's because his attorneys are like, you heard the judge earlier today. Like, do you really want to spend a night in jail?
Yeah.
So it may have happened. One thing I feel like we got to say before we move on from prosecutory or potpourri or trial, Trump trial potpourri, is how interesting it was that one of our Yale Law School classmates and law professor, Jed Sugarman, turned into like the latest version of Alan Dershowitz with his New York Times op-ed. Saying that this was all an embarrassment, the trial was a complete embarrassment and sham. And then Trump tweeted it out or whatever, truthed it out and made a big point about how, because Jed Sugarman says that this is correct, that it is in fact the case. Maybe he'll be the new attorney general. He'll be deciding whether to prosecute the two of us.
Yeah.
To me, it is a surreal moment. It was a surreal moment. I debated him on MSNBC. It's interesting. He's very... defensive about this is the way I would put it. I mean, he wanted to have a call beforehand. He was afraid of being attacked on television about this.
He doesn't do TV a lot, I don't think. And, it must be unnerving to be cast as the person who's defended Trump. And I mean, look, I think I disagree with him too. And for full disclosure for our listeners, he was one of our classmates in law school. I knew him a bit in law school. And since then, I co-authored a piece with him a while ago for Just Security, I think. And I like a lot of his writing. I mean, I think he has some scholarship on the interpretation of the word faithful in the take care clause, that, you know, the take care clause says that the president has to execute them faithfully, which I think is a compelling argument. So he's not, I would not compare him to Alan Dershowitz, even though, you know, in this case, he's obviously taking a very different view of the Manhattan prosecution.
Well, a couple thoughts on that, I would say, is one is, it's fair, it's not 100% comparison with Alan Dershowitz, but I do think when you write an op-ed in the New York Times, and say this is this trial of the former president of the United States is a complete embarrassment, total mistake, et cetera, make these bold statements, you have to be prepared to defend that opinion. It's not like you're giving this as a private opinion in a dinner party. You're putting in the New York Times and you're going on national television to defend it in multiple instances. It wasn't like I was the first person who discussed this matter with him on television. So from my perspective, you know, that's just part of being in the arena. Yeah. You know, a lot of people dislike what I have to say. A lot of people say nasty things. A lot of people threaten me. Like, that's part of life. And I think that's just part of talking about important things. I will also say I found that to be wildly overstated, because people who listen to this podcast know I am critical and have been publicly critical and have written things publicly critical of Alvin Bragg in this case. I've not been a rah-rah fan of this case. A more neutral analysis by someone who's actually practiced law, I will just say, is that while maybe I wouldn't have brought this case, the prosecution will probably win. And that's why I think this is a nice way of kind of coming back to here before we wrap this up. I think the prosecution is probably going to win this one. That's usually a safe bet, as I said in a prior episode, to bet on the prosecution in a criminal trial. And I think, you know, to say that like this is a total embarrassment when they're going to get a conviction that'll get held up on appeal, you know, maybe I think it's about a more nuanced take would be more accurate from my perspective. So, Asha, before we go, I will note you are in a hotel. I'm going to also note, yes, this is behind the curtain, that we had to take a break at the very beginning of the recording because Asha was hand-delivered snacks at her hotel. And I will just say, I do not stay at hotels that are fancy enough to deliver fancy snacks to my door. Okay, what is up with that? What kind of hotel are you staying in?
So I'm staying at a very weirdly named hotel in D.C. And I've got like drinking water here. Called Yours Truly.
Okay, that sounds very fancy. Is this like the...
Yeah, it's a little boutique-y hotel. And it's an IHG hotel. Basically, it was literally the only hotel that I could find that still had rooms, because I don't know what's going on in DC this week, but like everything was booked up. In fact, I'm here for 3 nights. I could only get a room for 2 nights, and then I'm going to go stay with a friend for 1 night. But yeah, I've been here before for a different like conference / event, and it's kind of one of these like little, you know, boutique-y little, they have little amenities and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's the lobby and bar area is very swanky and kind of, you know, hipster cool kind of thing.
See, I'm not cool. We already established, I think, in a prior episode, I'm not cool, right? I was the nerd.
What's your favorite hotel?
So I like these like business kind of hotels where there's like a desk that I can set up my computer and there's like a comfy chair and they will deliver your breakfast if you just put that little thing on the other side of the doorknob where you can like select, you know, I need 2 eggs and oatmeal or whatever. And they've got a night, you know, everything's just like, I know what it is. Like, I know I'm going to get free Wi-Fi. I know that I'm going to have my bed, and it's just that's what I like. Even when we were vacationing in Europe, it actually felt wonderful at the end after all these rustic hotels, like European hotels. At the very end, we went to a Hilton and it was just like normal. It was like very just what I was used to as an American.
Yeah, I like the boutique-y hotels because I like, you know, they usually have like slightly nicer like toiletries. I'm very big on the hotel toiletries. Like, I totally judge hotels based on the toiletries they have. That's kind of, you know, like, and they have like a yoga mat or like little touches that will I don't know, just make your, you know, like a bike that you can take out. I never take out the bike, but just the fact that it's there, like, I don't know, it just makes me feel like I'm in a cool hotel.
That is very fancy of you, Asha.
I like Kimpton hotels.
And there you go.
MSW Media.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.